State legislatures are asking more of the teachers who have to develop those young minds. From Colorado to Illinois, lawmakers are overhauling teacher evaluation systems, the Better to Win federal grants from the Race to the Top program. Tennessee won $500 million, and now teachers are finding how tough it is to make the grade. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports.
At Norman Binkley Elementary, Jana Beth Hunt wakes up her first graders by chanting the expectations each morning.
What do we give?
100%!
Hunt tries to give 100% herself, which is why she can't hide her disappointment. Tennessee's new observations grade teachers on a scale of 1 to 5. Many are scoring what feels like a C, which under the system isn't enough to get the job security of tenure.
I definitely feel like I'm better than an average teacher. I'm not happy with a 3, but I told my principal that, and he knows that I'm a perfectionist and that I want a 5. It's just extremely difficult to get a 5.
Some teachers say it feels impossible. To score at the highest level, students must demonstrate a mastery of the day's lesson. But the 4-page checklist is incredibly detailed, down to how handouts are even passed around. That kind of nitpicking is new for every teacher in Tennessee, but especially for veteran educators who may not have had anyone watching them in years. Kevin Huffman is the state's education commissioner.
We evaluated tenured teachers twice every 10 years, and virtually every teacher was told that they were at the top end of the scale.
That's not unusual. A study published last year by the New Teacher Project pointed out weaknesses in teacher evaluation systems across the country. Race to the Top money pushed through controversial changes in several states, often without full support of teachers. But Huffman says there's no way educators are performing at the top of their game when students aren't.
I don't understand how we can run an education system where we tell more than half the children, these are children in the state of Tennessee, hey, you're not proficient. But then we're uncomfortable saying to adults, not all of you are great.
I would love for him to come and spend the day or two with me. Tell me specifically what I need to do to improve.
Dorsell Benson has 30 years of experience and still puts in the long hours. But while other teachers are spending late nights prepping for the new high-stakes observations, Benson has accepted her mediocre marks.
Life is too short, and my health is much more valuable to me.
Benson says she and most teachers do the best they can even when they're handed a tough situation, like a student who reaches her fourth grade class still unable to read. Education officials, she says, don't seem to appreciate the challenge. Discouraging evaluation scores have torpedoed teacher morale, says Tim Tackett.
Do not forget that these are just big kids. They like to be patted on the back, too.
Tackett is a school board member from one of several districts that's fired off letters to the state asking for a complete review of the new evaluation system. They're also voicing concerns about the workload on administrators. Principal Barbara Ide says she struggles to find time for answering emails and talking to parents between all the additional observations.
Nothing was taken off the plate and a lot was added to it. But the part that was added to it is really the essence of what an instructional leader does. It's why we come to school.
Even while principals have some critiques, Ide isn't alone in recognizing the advantages of accountability. Being in classrooms, she says, has led to deeper discussions about teaching techniques.
So let's get started. Most people don't think of turtles as fast swimmers.
Lakeisha Desjarnett's eighth graders at Thurgood Marshall Middle School outside Nashville are huddled around for a lesson in finding the main idea of a story. Desjarnett's story is that she left her job in journalism 3 years ago to teach.
There are some who feel like, you know, I don't know what I got myself into, especially some of us first, second, and third year teachers, and especially those of us who change careers to come into this.
But Desjarnett says the challenge is bringing out her best. She just wonders how long she and others can keep up the new pace. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
And our last word in business today comes from Holly.
Hello and welcome to London Luton Airport. Security checks can take time, but your safety is our priority.
She's an assistant at that British airport. Her job is to remind passengers about restrictions on liquids and other security procedures.
Oh, and by the way, Holly is a hologram.
There are a few things you can do now to speed up the process. Remove all coats, jackets, and belts.
And that's Heather, the new holographic helper at another airport. British airports have deployed several of these virtual workers this year. They're actually high-definition images of real employees projected onto flat, transparent material. If you walk around to the side, you can see it's flat, but walk in front, and they're almost lifelike enough, airport officials hope anyway, to catch people's attention.
One airport official says he'd like to deploy holographic helpers in other areas, like immigration, and we may one day interact with them as well. Actually, being patted down by a hologram would be an improvement, wouldn't it, Ari?
I think so.
I think so. Well, that's the Business News on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
This week, a food pantry in Virginia announced it has to shut down temporarily because demand is so high it's run out of food. The pantry is run by a group called Action in Community Through Service in Dumfries, Virginia. The food pantry director, Rebecca McGee, says in the last 6 months they've seen a dramatic 40% increase in need. Lately, they've been serving 4,000 people a month.
On top of that, we are now serving the families that are part of the disaster from Tropical Storm Lee, but we were having the increase prior to even assisting those families.
And what's leading to that, do you think? I mean, the recession's been going on for so long now. What's changed?
I think that in our office, we also offer financial assistance with bills, and a lot of families will come in to request assistance from bills, but they're not necessarily willing to receive food assistance or feel that they're not at a point where they need to do that. And unfortunately, right now, we have so many families coming in for financial assistance because of their economic state, whether it's that they lost their job or they don't make a living wage, they don't have affordable housing, that they're finding that their need is greater than just financial assistance with a bill. They're now in need of food on their tables as well.
Which they hadn't been before.
They hadn't been before. A lot of families that are coming in receive help from other family members or friends in the community, and they've told us that they've tapped out those resources. They're no longer available because the people they were getting help from are now in need of help as well.
What have you been hearing from people, Rebecca, as they realize that the food they might have been counting on for the rest of the month, they're not going to get it from you?
That's one of the most difficult parts of this, watching individuals leave in tears because they rely on us to feed their families. You know, we've been able to try to refer them to other food pantries in the area, knowing that they're too having a difficult time and that they'll see an influx of families needing assistance while our doors are closed.
So there are other places they can go, but now you're worried that they'll be facing similar situations to yours.
Yes. One of the things that we did was contact those organizations and let them know that we were going to need to close our doors so that we could build up our supply so that we could reopen to serve families. And during that time, we had a discussion with them where they let us know that they, too, were having a very difficult time serving the families coming in. Part of that is hard for us knowing that we live in one of the wealthiest counties in the nation.
You're in Prince William County, which is right outside Washington, D.C. here.
Yes, ma'am.
Where does your food come from?
Our food comes from a variety of donors, whether it's the faith community, individuals, civic groups, grocery stores. We partner with the local farmers market to receive produce from them. We have a wonderful collaboration of donors.
So you're shutting down through the end of the month. The idea is you'll start up again, I gather, on November 1st. What do you think it looks like going forward?
We are hopeful that with the donations that are coming in and the wonderful rally that we've had from the community, that we would be able to open before November 1st.
Rebecca McGee is the program director for Action in Community Through Service, or ACTS. It's a food pantry in Dumfries, Virginia, that's had to temporarily shut down because it has run out of food. Rebecca, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Every so often, a book becomes a cultural phenomenon. Sybil was one such book. It was published in 1973, billed as the true story of a woman who suffered from multiple personality disorder. It was a huge bestseller and became a popular TV movie. Now a new book, called Sybil Exposed, reveals an even stranger story of the real Sybil. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
When Sybil first came out, it not only shot to the top of the bestseller lists, it also spawned a psychiatric phenomenon. Within a few years of its publication, reported cases of multiple personality disorder leapt from less than 100 to thousands. But, says writer Debbie Nathan, most of the story is based on a lie.
Shirley started acting like she had a lot of people inside her.
Shirley is Shirley Mason, the real Sybil. She grew up in the Midwest in a strict Seventh-day Adventist family. An emotionally needy young woman, she decided to seek psychiatric help. Shirley became unusually attached to her psychiatrist, Dr. Connie Wilbur, and she knew that Dr. Wilbur had a special interest in multiple personality disorder.
And Shirley feels, after a short time, that she's not really getting the attention she needs from Dr. Wilbur. One day she walks into Dr. Wilbur's office and she says, "I'm not Shirley, I'm Peggy." And she says this in a childish voice.
Dr. Wilbur believed she had stumbled on a remarkable case. She began seeing Shirley frequently and eventually teamed up with the writer Flora Schreiber to work on a book about her patient. The two women taped a series of interviews. In this excerpt, Dr. Wilbur describes the moment that Peggy first appeared. She uses the pseudonym Sylvia to protect Shirley's identity.
She said, "I'm Peggy." And she proceeded to tell me about herself, that Sylvia couldn't stand up for herself and she had to stand up for her. Sylvia couldn't get angry because her mother wouldn't let her, but she got angry. She knew it was a sin to get angry, but people got angry, so she got angry.
Shirley became increasingly dependent on Dr. Wilbur for emotional and even financial support. She was eager to give her psychiatrist what she wanted.
Once she got this diagnosis, she started generating more and more personalities. She had babies, she had little boys, she had teenage girls. She wasn't faking. I think a better way to talk about what Shirley was doing was that she was acceding to a demand that she have this problem.
Dr. Wilbur began injecting Shirley regularly with sodium pentothal, which was then being used to help people remember traumatic events that they had repressed. Under the influence of drugs and hypnosis, the very suggestible Shirley uncovered her many personalities. In this excerpt from a recording of one session, Dr. Wilbur talks to Shirley about a new personality who has surfaced.
"What's your name?"
"I'm Shirley."
She said, "Her name is Shirley." And she said, "It was my grandma and..."
"And no, she said it was her grandma and her mother."
"Mm-hmm. Is this another part of you, sweetie?"
"I'm thinking about it. It feels like it sort of..."
"Yeah, it feels like it's sort of another part of you."
Reading through Flora Schreiber's papers, Nathan says, it becomes obvious that the writer knew that Shirley's story was not entirely true. Memories of a traumatic tonsillectomy, for instance, morphed into a lurid story of abuse. And Schreiber seemed eager to pump up or even create drama where none existed. If Schreiber had doubts, she suppressed them.
She already had a contract and she already had a deadline. She was in the middle of writing the book. So she had sort of the dilemma that, you know, all journalists have nightmares about. What if my thesis turns out to be wrong as I do my research, but it's too late?
At one point, Shirley tried to set things straight. She wrote a letter to Dr. Wilbur admitting that she had been lying. "I do not really have multiple personalities," she wrote. "I do not even have a double. I am all of them." Dr. Wilbur dismissed the letter as Shirley's attempt to avoid going deeper in her therapy. By now, says Nathan, Dr. Wilbur was too heavily invested in her patient to let her go.
She had already started giving presentations about this case. She was planning a book. She was very, very attached to the case emotionally and professionally, and I don't think she could give it up.
And what about Shirley?
She got the very, very strong impression when she went in and brought this letter of recantation to Dr. Wilbur that if she didn't go with the program, she was not going to have Dr. Wilbur anymore. And Dr. Wilbur was giving her 14, 18 hours of therapy a week. So how could you give up Dr. Wilbur?
The book succeeded beyond anyone's expectations, selling some 6 million copies around the world, and was made into a TV movie starring Sally Field. As that movie draws to a close, Joanne Woodward, as Dr. Wilbur, describes a happy ending for Sybil.
Today, Sybil lives peacefully in a small college town where she's a professor of art. There's not enough time in the day for her to do everything she wants. But that time, in every sense, is her own. She tells me she's happy. I know she's free.
Shirley Mason almost had that life, but when Sybil came out and people began to suspect it was her, she fled, moving to a home near Dr. Wilbur, living in her shadow and dependent on her psychiatrist until the end of her life. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
When word spread today that Muammar Gaddafi was captured and killed, Libyans all over the world rejoiced. Their 42-year-long nightmare was over. The brutal violence that many had suffered at the hands of the regime, the prison sentences, the missing relatives, it would all finally be done. Sarah Bershon is one of those celebrating. She knows what the violence has been like. Her relatives have been put in jail and killed. Her parents fled Libya before she was born, but they've always hoped to return to their homeland. Sarah has this essay on what her family felt when they heard the news.
Thursday, October 20th, is a day I will never forget. My brother woke me up at 5 a.m. He kept repeating, "They got him. They caught Gaddafi." I was so dazed. I didn't believe it. A world without Gaddafi seemed too good to be true. I was born in Kansas, but I have always been a Libyan. Before I was born, my parents were active in the opposition. When my father finished high school, he knew that the only options for those opposed to Gaddafi were jail or death. He chose instead to leave the country. After he left, he and my mom were married. It was a big wedding, and all their friends and relatives attended. The only person missing was the groom. This morning, my whole family was speechless. I called my father, who was so excited, he couldn't think of anything to say to me. Later, he was interviewed on Al Jazeera. "Do you feel like you're dreaming?" they asked. "It's too good to be a dream," he replied. "This has been a long process. We were hopeful on February 17th when the protests began. My mom began to shop for new furniture. I told her this was no time to redo our house. But she told me, these things are for our home in Libya. We called our relatives in Libya. My uncle cried on the phone, 'You can come home, you can come home.' He doesn't know his nieces and nephews. He doesn't know his own siblings. They have lived in a different world for over 20 years. But then things turned violent. We heard reports of Gaddafi's crimes against the Libyan people. Our hope began to fade. Then reports that Gaddafi's sons had been caught turned out to be false. Each time we got bad news, we felt that our hope of a free Libya was getting farther away. So when I called my grandmother in Libya today, she was crying, but this time with happiness. I'm taking a year off from school this year to help out and volunteer in Libya. A year ago, moving home would have seemed crazy. Who would want to live in a country run by a dictator, where the youth have no dreams? But today, it doesn't seem ridiculous. In fact, it's just starting to seem possible.
Sarah Bershon lives near Chicago. She recently graduated from the University of Illinois at Chicago, and she plans to go to Libya later this year. Her father is already there. He's serving as a member of the Transitional National Council in a town southwest of Tripoli.